Hello, I'm John Priestner, analyst for the European Pharma and Biotech team at JP Morgan. Welcome to the Ipsen session at the 43rd annual JP Morgan Healthcare Conference. From Ipsen, it gives me great pleasure to introduce the CEO, David Lowe. So before I hand over to David, I'll just remind you that when we get to the Q&A session, you can either ask your questions through the portal or by putting your hand up and we'll bring a microphone over to you. So with that, I'll hand over to David. Welcome to the conference.
Thank you, John, and good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to our investors' presentation on Ipsen. As John said, I'm David Lowe. I'm the CEO of Ipsen. This is our safe harbor statement. And I would like to now walk you through our strategy that we have rolled out in 2020, which we put under the umbrella of Focus Together for Patients and Society, relying on four pillars. So on the one hand side, we want to bring full potential of our medicines to patients. We want to build a high-value, sustainable pipeline, deliver efficiencies to enable investment and support the growth, and also boost the culture of collaboration, excellence, and impact on patients and on society, as we have a role to play there as well. This strategy has really delivered, and I'm going to walk you through now the different phases we have gone through in the period from 2020 to 2023. We have set the foundations with our new strategy, focusing on oncology with solid and liquid tumors, on rare disease, and also on neuroscience. We have in fact spun off our consumer healthcare division, and we are now a fully focused specialty care company. We have done a lot of deals which now lead to a lot of launches. So in the period of 24 to 27, we are going to see multiple launches that we're executing as we speak. And we're also going to continue to significantly expand our pipeline based on the firepower that we have. We have guided the market with above 5 billion up to 2027. In fact, today we already have 2 billion firepower. So you're going to see us make more deal in the preclinical space, the early clinical late stage, but also on on-market compounds or even on mergers and acquisitions. And then we have in 2028 a company which is looking very different, because we're going to have a balanced and diversified portfolio across the three therapeutic areas with all the launches that we're executing, and we're going to have a sustained growth based on the throughput of our pipeline, but also on the external innovation bolt-ons that we are going to conduct. In fact, when you look at 2020, we had one product which was selling more than 500 million, being Somatuline. End of 2023, we already had four products being above 500 million peak sales with Dysport, Cabometyx, Decapeptyl, and Somatuline. And we're projecting that by 2027, and that does not include any late-stage deals yet, that we're going to have these seven products being above 500 million with Iqirvo, Tazverik, Bylvay, Onivyde, Dysport, Cabometyx, and Decapeptyl. So much more diversified across the three therapeutic areas and standing on multiple legs, which bodes very well for having a sustainable, long-term oriented company. Our guidance that we rolled out at our Capital Markets Day end of 2023 was to give a guidance of, for the period between 23 and 27, of a growth which is above 7% or equal. You can see that by Q3 in 2024, we had a growth rate of 9.2%, so beating that expectation already. We have given a core operating margin guidance of equal or above 32% of sales, and with a priority of capital allocation going to external innovation with a firepower of accumulated up to 5 billion by 2027. What is now investment case for Ipsen? And you can see that there are four important aspects to look at when you consider investing into Ipsen. The first one is that we're fully focused on specialty care and executing well on those three therapeutic areas. We also have a strong global footprint. We have a well-balanced geographical presence with medicines registered in over 100 markets around the world. We have an expanding pipeline with six pivotal readouts by 2026 and constituting a mix of life cycle management and completely new drugs. And then we have been executing, and we will continue to execute very strongly on the external innovation strategy, where we're licensing drugs from the preclinical space to phase one, phase two, phase three, but also on market. And you have seen us do more than 35 new molecules bringing into Ipsen since 2020 across all these different areas of therapeutic and also of the different stages of development. So let me zoom in into these different aspects, and I will start with a focus on specialty care and our three therapeutic areas. So the first one and the most important one currently, that's oncology. Oncology is constituting about 3/4 of our sales. Oncology will continue to grow. We see on one hand side a gradual erosion over the longer term from Somatuline, but then a strong growth from all the other products that you see here, Decapeptyl in prostate cancer, Cabometyx, which we are launching still in the metastatic renal cell carcinoma, and where we have just recently also submitted for the neuroendocrine indication. We have also Onivyde in metastatic pancreatic cancer that we are launching now in the first line indication. And we see Tazverik, where we are going to unblind the second line indication in follicular lymphoma in combination with R-square. So that strategy of going after solid and liquid tumors, being in niche tumors or in biomarker-driven tumors, has really delivered. And we have been able to actually make several deals in that segment or get approvals in that segment. And these, tendency in oncology or hematology that the patient pools are becoming smaller with better understanding of the disease, with biomarker analysis, actually bodes very well for a mid-sized company like us, because we can very specifically focus on it, and we are going after peak sales of about 400 to 900 million, and that's exactly what we're seeing now happening in oncology. But then on this, we're adding on now a very attractive rare disease franchise, currently representing 5% of the sales. But of course, that's going to increase very significantly, because with the Bylvay launch in PFIC and Alagille syndrome, we see very strong growth of Bylvay. And we're going to have the addition also of biliary atresia indication in the 2026 unblinding. On Iqirvo, that's a license again that we had from Genfit. We have been launching since summer last year in primary biliary cholangitis. We're also conducting a trial in PSC, so very interesting product. And then we also have the launch of Sohonos in FOP. So in rare disease, again, it's a bit like in oncology. We see that as a mid-sized company, we can ideally serve these patients with high unmet medical needs, which are more niche indications. And for us as Ipsen, this is very interesting, because the go-to-market model is something that we can stem very easily. And so it's a very attractive market segment. And then the third one, and here we are selling about 22% of our sales, that's in neurotoxins, where we see very attractive market growth in both key indications in the treatment space, but also in aesthetics. And we also see that there are significant barriers to entry, because neurotoxins are very difficult to produce. We are investing significantly into our production capacity in Wrexham, because we anticipate that the market is going to continue having strong growth, and we want to be able to serve that potential of that market and take market share. So we have been guiding the market on high single-digit growth for this sport. And we are going to continue to expand here the market footprint through life cycle management by adding, for example, the migraine indication, but also by our completely revolutionary new long-acting neurotoxin, which is a recombinant botulinum toxin A and B. So it's both A and B in one drug. And I'm going to just talk a little bit more about this in a second. Let me go now to the global footprint, where I told you we have a global presentation here, that with 33% of our sales coming from North America. We anticipate that North America is going to show very strong growth in the coming years. We have a lot of launching happening there. Europe is representing about 40% of the sales currently. again, having sustained growth over the coming years with a lot of launches and based also on the sustained growth with Dysport and Cabometyx. And then the rest of the world is representing about a quarter of our sales. We are, in fact, opening up new affiliates. For example, in Japan, we have opened up Saudi Arabia, we have opened up Colombia, and that is giving us additional growth opportunities by the geographical expansion next to expanding our portfolio for those countries, obviously, as well. Now, I talked about our pipeline and the readouts, which are exciting. You can see here our pipeline. You see in green the oncology indications, in blue the the rare disease indications, and in orange you see the neurotoxin one. So you can see that we have a very well-balanced pipeline now across the three therapeutic areas. Cabometyx, we have been filing the neuroendocrine tumor indication where Exelixis just got the positive feedback that they don't have to have an advisory committee with FDA, so they're expecting the action date by April. We should see an approval coming also very soon, probably by mid-2025. We are conducting the phase 3 trial on Tazverik in combination with R-square. That's going to open up the follicular indication, not just in a much larger pool, which is the second line indication, but also it's going to open up the international markets where Tazverik has not been launched so far. It's launched now in relapse refractory third line or fourth line in the US only. So that's going to open up an additional market. We have recently done a deal with Day One on tovorafenib. That's an indication for pediatric low-grade glioma. Very high unmet need of children being terribly affected by this low-grade glioma because it exercises pressure on the brain, and so therefore it has big impact on the children. So there is a high expectation on that drug. We're going to soon file that drug in Europe. And then I'm pleased to say that our efforts on the preclinical space have borne fruit, and we have the ERK inhibitor, which is now entered into phase 1 clinical trial, and we are in the dose escalation on this new modality. Soon enough, we're going to see more drugs coming into the clinic here as well, with a BRAF inhibitor in 2025 and more to come. Then on the rare disease, we have the biliary atresia trial running right now, as well as onycorbo, the Elspire, which is the below 1.67 trial in PBC. But also, interestingly enough, we are conducting a trial in PSC with icorbo, and you're going to soon hear results from that trial. That is a very interesting indication that we're also going after. In the same indication of PSC, we also have a systemic IBAT inhibitor with ritivixibat. That's also in phase 2. And so there are potentially even combination possibilities of icorbo and ritivixibat in that indication. And then, again, in rare, in FOP, we have fidrisertib with the Falcon trial for children which have this bone disease and which is very crippling. Often at 20 years of age, they unfortunately need the support of a wheelchair, and the median life expectancy is only about 47 years of age. So if we can bring additional hope to these patients, that would be absolutely fantastic. Moving on then to the neurotoxin space, we have a big opportunity in front of us. Dysport is being now developed in chronic and episodic migraine. That's a $1 billion market which Botox basically had for itself. So we hope we have a positive readout very soon in both chronic and episodic. And then, very excitingly, we have the long-acting neurotoxin, which is being developed in the aesthetic indication, where the proof of concept is going to be this year. And also in the treatment space, in spasticity, but also we have just started now in chronic and episodic migraine with long-acting. And you can imagine that for people suffering from migraine, if you have a much longer-acting neurotoxin, which we have a target profile of about 6 to 9 months, that can totally change the way you have to live with the disease, because instead of injecting every 3 months, you suddenly can inject every 6 or 9 months. So we're very much looking forward to these results as well. What does this mean in terms of major upcoming pipeline milestones? We are going to see potentially the approval of the neuroendocrine tumor this year with Cabometyx. we're going to see the filing and potential approval, best case, end of this year, perhaps beginning of next year, with tovorafenib in relapsed refractory pediatric low-grade glioma, and then also the readout of the fidrisertib trial. 2026 is going to be also an eventful year, where we have 5 unblindings with Bylvay in biliary atresia, Iqirvo on Aspire, and Dysport in the 2 migraine indication, and Tazverik in the second line follicular lymphoma indication. So we have a lot of potential launches coming up in the near future. Let me just elaborate a little bit quickly on the Iqirvo Aspire trial. That's a global randomized phase 3 trial, double-blind placebo-controlled, in patients which are currently being not fully at control, so being with an ALP level between 1 and 1.67. Our current phase 3 has been carried out in the above 1.67. This one is going lower, but on patients which are still symptomatic for their liver disease. So the readout is expected in 2026 on this one. And now I want to spend a bit of time on our long-acting neurotoxin, which I have to say I'm very excited about. It can go into the therapeutic space and into the aesthetic space. We have the 3 phase 2 trials ongoing. They're all proof of concept trials. We are in the phase of the dose escalation and the dose finding. We have actually been able to push the dose much more than what we have thought, because we see almost no limiting dose side effects. And that is very interesting, because then you can push the duration of the coverage through a long-acting neurotoxin to have much longer duration. So we think it can get to 6 to 9 months. And of course, that has a big benefit for not only the patients, but also for the healthcare system, because then you need to inject the patient much less frequently, and that is a big advantage for both the patient and the healthcare system. So more to come. You will soon hear more on the long-acting neurotoxins. And then on the external innovation strategy, I said we brought on board 35 new molecules into our pipeline or on the market with the launches that we have. And here I would like to make a zoom. You see on the right-hand side the day one deal that we have signed, ex-US licensing in pediatric oncology, and where we're going to file in soon, 2025. And then on the preclinical early stage, we have licensed in exciting new modalities. We have 2 deals that we have done on new ADCs, one with Sutro and one with Forcine. We have also licensed in T-cell engagers, because we believe they can play a very important role in oncology. One with Marengo, where we have 2 preclinical molecules, and also one with Biomunex. And then we have done also in CNS with Skyhawk a collaboration on 2 small molecules addressing RNA targets. So very busy period. We're integrating them. We're putting teams on them. We are advancing them very rapidly as we speak, but very exciting now. So in conclusion, I'm thrilled to say that we have a strong momentum and we're delivering on our roadmap that we have set for 2027 with a strong top-line momentum. I remind you, we have seen 9.2% growth in the Q3, and our yearly results are going to be published very soon. And we have seen growth across all 3 therapeutic areas. We have multiple near-term pipeline opportunities, and we're going to continue to do deals based on our strong firepower and having a really strong focus on the excellence in execution, but at the same time also having a commitment to society and being really sustainable in terms of CO2 energy consumption, so where we have reduced significantly our CO2 emissions by over 90%, switching to completely green energy. So with this, I would like to thank you, and we can now take questions.
Excellent. So just to remind you, if you'd like to ask a question, you can raise your hand and we'll get a microphone over to you. Otherwise, you can ask a question through the portal. And so maybe with that, I can kick off with one of my own. So maybe if you could help us with what are some of the real key pushes and pulls around the growth outlook in 2025, and how should we really be thinking about the potential for margin development?
So clearly, I mean, I'm very excited about our launches, and so we have to execute very well on the launches. And then we are enjoying at the moment right now a very nice tailwind, because we have seen that on Somatuline, where we anticipated actually a bit of an acceleration of the erosion, it's almost the contrary. Cipla and Advanz had significant interruptions on supply, so we were able to, you know, kickstart our supply immediately and deliver and regain market share there in a significant fashion. Of course, that's not going to last, but you know, we will see how long we can enjoy that period.
Definitely. And then in terms of potential kind of margin development, do you see 25 as a year of investment into your launches? Is it about execution? How should we think about that?
Yeah, I mean, we're going to give official guidance on the margin, obviously, once we have the annual results publication. But you know, with the investments that we have already done in 2024, I think we're going to have an attractive margin also in 2025. And then on top of this, if we get further tailwind on the Somatuline, that's going to help the margin obviously as well. But so clearly, I think we're going to have a very nice margin also for 2025.
Definitely. And at the CMD in December 23, you gave medium-term guidance for the sales growth of greater than 7%. I guess just over a year on now, how are you kind of progressing along that path? What do you see as some of the key growth drivers out to 2027? And maybe what would have to happen for you to exceed that guidance?
I mean, you have seen, okay, I stressed the 9.2% growth that we have seen by Q3. Of course, we are thrilled, you know, to do very well. And I think we will also see a nice Q4, given you know, the problem of our competitors on the generics. But we're going to publish those results very soon. For the future, the launches are going to play an important role. We anticipate that Sun Pharma is going to launch eventually also as a second generic to Advanz in Europe on Somatuline, because they got the registration in October. But they have still not launched. I mean, and we know it's a very difficult to produce drug, so we have to see how this is going to play out. But the launches are really going to drive. And then, of course, you know, we have the in-market compounds like Cabometyx, we have Dysport, we have Decapeptyl, etc. All of those are going to continue the growth that we have seen. So it's an attractive portfolio now.
Definitely. And I remember 2 years ago, it was the Bylvay deal that was announced, so what's the current thinking around appetite for more M&A? And then what kind of deals are you looking at? Which kind of therapeutic areas? And is there really a preference between in-licensing or acquisitions?
Mm-hmm. We're going to continue doing deals across the spectrum. So from preclinical, phase 1, 2, 3, and on the market. Regarding a late-stage deal, ideally, we would love to do one in oncology. And the reason is that, of course, we have the expiration of Cabometyx in 2029. So we have still, you know, a lot of time until that point. But we just want to make sure that we continue building our pipeline in order to offset, you know, future patent expirations like Cabometyx. But that's the only one in this decade, right? So actually, I think we can absolutely get there. And then we can also add other deals, later stage deals, for example, in rare in a second step. But that's what we try to materialize right now.
Excellent. And then, so Akervo launch, that's something that I guess investors have really been focusing on recently. So how has that launch been performing versus your expectations? What's the initial feedback from physicians? And how do you really see that launch trajectory developing over the next couple of years?
Right. Akervo launch is going very well. We have seen that new class PPARs have been greeted with a lot of welcome. And we have a lot of physicians prescribing Akervo. We are doing very well on the launch. Clearly, you know, we expected perhaps penetrating slightly faster, because we were hoping if we can work with the physicians to actually call in the patients more rapidly. What we have learned is that they're a bit overrun, the big academic centers in hepatology, because on the one hand side, we are launching Bylvay in PFIC and Alagille. We have also, of course, a competitor in that space. Then now we have two companies launching PPARs, us and Gilead. But at the same time, we have also, for example, Madrigal coming into MASH. So the physicians, they have a certain limited capacity, and so they're going to call in the patients on the routine visits every 6 months. So we're going to see the switches coming in gradually. patients being, if they're uncontrolled, being put on a new drug like Acuervo. So that's going pretty well.
Definitely. And at the end of last year, we had an interesting development with the current second-line standard of care in PBC, Ocaliva, where it was removed from the market in Europe, but then not granted full approval in the US, but still maintaining that accelerated approval. How has your thinking changed around kind of the uptake for Acuervo based on this opportunity? And in terms of new starts for Acuervo, what are you seeing for new starts from de novo patients versus those maybe switching from Ocaliva?
Yeah, so clearly the withdrawal in Europe is going to potentially accelerate a bit the penetration of Acuervo, because we see that in Germany, for example, or in Italy, they are now very actively switching patients. And we are on the market in Germany already and in the UK already. We have a compassionate use program also where people can be put where we don't have reimbursement yet, like in Italy, for example. So that's actually an opportunity for us to penetrate a bit faster. In the US, what the FDA has done is they decided to leave it on the market for now, but they have really significantly, you know, strengthened the warnings in the label. So what we're observing now is that basically no new patients are being put on Ocaliva, and the, you know, stable patients sometimes are not being switched yet, because the physicians, when they have a stable patient, they think, okay, I'm not going to touch it, why should I switch them? Sometimes, however, given the stronger wording, they are proactively switching those patients. So it's also an opportunity for us, definitely, because that's going to accelerate a bit as well in the US, the penetration. On your second question on the split, where are the prescriptions coming from? So we see 60% of the prescriptions coming from de novo second line, so they have never seen Ocaliva. And then we have about 35% on either Ocaliva being stopped proactively and being switched to Acuervo, or when they failed Ocaliva, then they are being switched. So it's a very healthy mix. You know, often when you have a new launch, sometimes physicians want to try it first in a last line setting and then they work their way up. But I think given the profile that we see with Acuervo, which is a very, you know, well-tolerated profile, not causing pruritus like, for example, Ocaliva, but actually preventing pruritus. So there is an opportunity here for us to really accelerate that penetration.
Definitely. And you mentioned a competitor, Gilead and Livdelzi. So how do you really see the reimbursement landscape playing out in the US? Do you expect plans to cover both assets? Could one product get preferred status? And then based on the approved labels that we see now, how do you really compare the two assets, and how do you see the market share potentially playing out?
So on your first question, we have not been really approached by payers, you know, to choose one or the other. And in fact, on Bylvay, it's the same thing. There is no, you know, like calling on us and like you have to choose the one or the other. I think there is a recognition that, especially on new launches, the physicians need to also figure out which drug for which patient. And I remind you, we have actually a dual mechanism of action. We are a PPAR alpha and delta. And that can have a beneficial effect potentially, and so we are collecting more data on the immune system, and that can impact on the fatigue that we see a lot in these patients, or on fibrosis on the liver. So those are aspects which currently we are following up, and we have just presented data at AASLD, for example, on fatigue having a very positive impact when patients take Acuervo.
Excellent. And during your presentation, you also mentioned the ELSPIRE trial. So that's in patients with ALP of 1 to 1.67. Is this currently included in your Acuervo peak sales guidance at all? How big of an opportunity could this be? And is there potential for patients to start using, or these patients particularly, to start using Acuervo already?
Mm-hmm. Perhaps I start with your last question. Yes, they can start already, because technically speaking, the label is not restricted regarding the ALP levels. So a physician can prescribe today even in below 1.67. We see that actually 20% of our scripts in the de novo second line come from patients that are below 1.67 already. Now the question is, how can you actually increase that share? Because that pool is a very big pool as well. It's equally big as the above 1.67. And there are a lot of symptomatic patients in the below 1.67. So they have a, you know, treatment benefit if they're being put on drug. And we want to document that by conducting that phase three now and really having more data for the physicians to make the informed decision and really use that drug more often in that indication as well.
Fantastic. And then maybe if we switch gears a bit and move over to somatuline. So you kind of, we saw some continued shortages from generic competitors both in the US and in Europe last year. And how are you thinking about that developing in 2025? Could that stick around a little bit longer, or what's the latest thinking?
Yeah, you can actually Google that, so it's public information. Yes, it is going to stick a bit longer around. You know, we have heard Cipla say that they might come back by Q1, the end of Q1, and Advanz has given a bit different messages that they have informed some of the governments in Europe that they are going to have difficulties until the summer. So, yeah, in the first half, I think we're still going to see some tailwind for us because they seem to have problems on the production. But we have to see how this goes.
And then longer term, how much of a tail do you think there could be with somatuline? How much of the share do you think you could retain?
Like other drugs, you know, which are difficult to produce, they are going to erode gradually over time and then probably have a certain socket. How big that socket is, it's difficult to say, but you can look at other analogs and you can see that they retain quite a bit of sales. So it's actually, for us, knowing exactly how to produce that drug, it's even going to be still continuing to generate cash for us in the longer term. Not as much as now, obviously, but we're going to see this erosion, you know, perhaps accelerate a bit because Sun Pharma is eventually also going to come in, and perhaps other competitors. But we see that the current ones, they're really struggling.
And then you also mentioned about your long-acting neurotoxin. So what's the latest thinking around timing for the readout for the phase 2 Lantic study in aesthetics? And what are you hoping to see in that phase 2 data to give you confidence to take the development forwards? And I guess, as an opportunity, how much of an incremental opportunity could that be for your toxin franchise?
Mm-hmm. So the readout of the proof of concept is probably happening in the second half of this year. What we want to see is clearly a longer duration and, of course, a very good tolerability. That's very important when you have a long-acting neurotoxin, right? You don't want to have any side effects popping up and sticking around for long term. So those are the two main criteria, I would say. The target product profile is a duration of at minimum 6 months, but rather 9 months. You know, I think with the mechanism of action that I have laid out, the first data that we have seen is very promising, but now we need to wait for the readout of this phase 2 data. That could, of course, then lead to a phase 3 development in aesthetics, and that we are also awaiting the proof of concept in the treatment space, and really open up a very, very significant opportunity. I mean, if you think about it, Botox is selling more than 4 billion, almost 5 billion. That's very attractive. And we have a plan in the therapeutic space to also go very broad, which we did not do at the time with Dysport. We're catching up on Dysport and doing the migraine study. But there are many, many more indications that we could go into with neurotoxin, because there are a lot of publications of other indications where neurotoxins are being used, not always based on the phase 3. It's sometimes off-label use. But we're looking at the business case on really making it much broader. And so it could significantly expand the market potential for neurotoxin use.
Definitely. And then sticking with the neurotoxin franchise, can you maybe talk us through some of the market dynamics that you've seen in both therapeutics and aesthetics in the US and Europe for Dysport particularly? And maybe what were some of the key drivers of upside or risks to downside for growth for Dysport in 25?
In both markets, in the aesthetics, which in the US, for example, is done by Galderma, and in the therapeutics, which is done by us, both markets are continuing to expand. And in both markets, we continue to gain market share. So it's a double effect. That's why we're saying we're guiding on a high single-digit growth rate. And the same is true for ex-US. Yeah. So it's very attractive market.
Excellent. And you also mentioned that you've got a readout this year for fidrisertib. So that's the phase 2 Falcon data. And I believe the study's enrolled around 100 patients and is a placebo-controlled study. So how should we think about that in terms of fileability? Do you think you could go to file off the back of that data? And then what kind of opportunity do you see for that? Because you obviously have Sohonos already approved, so how does fidrisertib fit into the portfolio there?
So on fidrisertib, I think you mentioned a very important point on the placebo control. Sohonos was versus natural history, and that was something that the European regulator wanted to see, a placebo-controlled trial, which now we're doing on fidrisertib. That's the first point. So that's going to open up geographies ex-US. So we have Sohonos only currently registered in the US, but with fidrisertib, if the trial is successful, we could also expand beyond that. Second, the indication that we are having now with Sohonos is restricted to 10 and 12 years of age, girls and boys. With fidrisertib, we are going down to 5 years of age. So that would expand the market, and this disease actually has a very early onset. And fidrisertib, we don't have the issue of the premature growth platelet closure, which was one of the side effects that led to discussion on Sohonos, but led then, despite, because we had a good balanced risk profile on preventing the disease in the U.S., so the approval was done there. But fidrisertib doesn't have that. So we hope we're going to see nice efficacy and a good tolerability profile. So potentially fidrisertib can replace Sohonos or can add on Sohonos, so we're doing preclinical studies also on combination.
Perfect. And then we also spoke earlier about the Albireo acquisition 2 years ago. So I guess, how has Bylvay been performing versus your expectations? And are there any notable changes in terms of how you see the outlook for this asset over the last 2 years?
Bylvay is developing really nicely in PFIC, but also now in Alagille syndrome. So, we actually find that in PFIC we have also older patients, which we haven't modeled in the forecast originally because we modeled the babies being put on it. But what we find is that since this is a genetic disease, you can work your way backwards once you have diagnosed the baby. Sometimes the parents or somebody in the family also has that genetic defect. And therefore, we're also detecting more older patients that are being currently put on drugs. So it's going very well.
Excellent. And you also mentioned the phase 3 BOLD readout in biliary atresia. So I believe a competitor may have also had a disappointment in that area. And given the kind of similar mechanism, what's your level of confidence in the readout from the BOLD study? And then what are you thinking about in terms of the potential magnitude of benefit you could be looking for?
So the reason why we think Livmarli failed was that they had a significantly underpowered trial and the wrong endpoint. They didn't take an outcome endpoint. We have taken an outpoint endpoint, which is, transplantation, a liver transplantation. So that's a very hard endpoint. So we have to wait now for the data coming through. But obviously, we would hope that less patients have to go to liver transplant.
Definitely. And how do you see the competitive profiles of those two products? So Bylvay comparing, obviously, to Mirum's Livmarli in both PFIC and Alagille syndrome, where you're already approved.
The reason why we were doing the deal on Bylvay was that we felt that with a capsule, that can be an advantage because you can open the capsule and dilute the pellets in liquid if a baby cannot take solid food yet. Between 6 months and 12 months of age, they typically, you can start having them eat applesauce or a chocolate pudding and etc. and you can sprinkle it. But then once they grow older, and I think that's a big advantage, you can give them a capsule. Now, with Livmarli, it's a liquid that you have to give twice a day, and we have to give Bylvay once a day. They have to give it 30 minutes before food. We can give it with food, so there were also advantages on the profile. Now, Livmarli has worked on the formulation, and they got a tablet also approved in Europe. So, and we are working also on the liquid. But I think we have very strong value proposition on Bylvay.
Excellent. And I think we're coming to the end of our time here. So maybe just a final question to finish. So what are the key catalysts that investors should really be thinking about over the next 12 to 18 months? And I guess which of them are you most excited about?
clearly, we want to see further growth of the products we already have launched since a while ago, like Carbometrics, Disport, etc. And I think we're executing well on those. Then also on the launches, we have to show that we are launching these drugs very well, and we continue to take market share and grow the market. And then we need a bit of a portion of luck on Somatuline to see if we have a bit more tailwind. But we're not counting on this one in our guidance. This is just like the icing on the cake, I would say. And then, of course, also, see us do more deals and good deals. And I think many of, like Quirbo, Bylvay, these were very good deals. Tazverik, I think, is a little bit below our expectations. And with the second line follicular indication, we can really expand the market from there. So also excited to see the readout of those trials coming up.
Definitely. Very exciting. And thank you for joining us, David.
Thank you, John.